Okay, so we have been doing the gradual training. I have been trying to compare it to the Noble Eightfold Path. And the idea of sensory strength, that's part of right effort. The effort to overcome the unwholesome and the effort to develop the wholesome. This is part of an important part of the path, obviously. In fact, I think this is maybe one of the most important parts of the path. And I think often the idea of right effort is not talked about enough, because the right effort really involves the working with the mind itself to overcome the unwholesome and to develop wholesome habits instead. This is obviously very important. So to be able to overcome the bad states of mind and to develop the good states, you need two things. The first thing you need is you need a motivation. You need a reason why you should do this, right? So you need to be very clear why. That's the first thing. And the second thing you need to do it, you need some kind of skillful means, if you like, a certain ways to help you to overcome these two things. So I'm going to talk a bit about now about the why to overcome these things, to give the motivation, and afterwards also a bit about how to actually overcome these things. So the first sutta I want to... Sorry, go ahead. If I talk too much, please stop me. That's okay. Okay, so the first sutta is the Anguttara Nikaya 2.13. That's the first sutta which comes after the one we're looking at now. And this sutta goes as follows. Bhikkhus, there are these two powers. What two? The power of reflection and the power of development. Have you got that sutta? Yeah, you're just listening. That's good, yeah. The power of reflection and the power of development. And what is the power of reflection? Here, someone reflects thus. Bodily misconduct has a bad result in the present life and in the future life. Verbal misconduct has a bad result in the present life and in the future life. Mental misconduct has a bad result in the present life and in the future life. Having reflected thus, he abandons bodily misconduct and develops bodily good conduct. He abandons verbal misconduct and develops verbal good conduct. He abandons mental misconduct and develops mental good conduct. He maintains himself in purity. This is called the power of reflection. And what is the power of development? And I'm not going to read this, but the power of development basically is the four jhanas, the four deep stages of samadhi. So this is quite interesting, because what this means is that the way to overcome unwholesome things, the way to overcome any bad mental states in particular, is all about how we reflect. It's how we think about things. And if we think about things in the right way, if we reflect in the right way, that is how this actually comes about. And then once you have overcome these negative things through reflecting in the right way, that is when meditation has a possibility. And this is what this development usually means. Development, the Pali word is bhavana. And bhavana, in the narrow sense, means meditation practice. So it is how we reflect that is important. And through reflection, through reflecting in the right way, that is how you guide your mind to the right track. And you will see here that it gives you some indication already. It is sutta is very short. It doesn't say much, but it gives you some idea about how that reflection should be. And basically the reflection is that the results, if you have the defilements, too many defilements in the mind, is going to always lead to bad results. This is essentially what this reflection is about. And you can see here also it talks about bad results, not only in this life, but also in future lives. So here comes this idea we started off with right view. Right view being at the beginning of the path. And here, that right view, you can use that right view here to reflect on the long-term consequences of these things. So you here it says that you use this reflection both to act morally in body and also in speech. But now we are focusing mostly on the mind at this stage. And you can also see here that the sutta says that not only do you reflect in this way, you abandon bad conduct, but you also develop the good conduct. As well as I was talking about before, about the morality in Buddhism has two sides, the positive side and the negative side. And they always go together. And you can see that this exactly the same thing is happening here. So what does it mean that it becomes a power? It's called the power of reflection, right? It becomes a power when that reflection, when you have done it so often, when it has sunk in so deeply, when you really understand that this is a problem, that as soon as you bring it up to the mind, then you can abandon those unwholesome qualities. That's when it is a power, when it's called the power of reflection. It has the ability to abandon those. As it said in the previous sutta we said, it dispels the unwholesome thought, obliterates them, abandons them. That's when it is the power of reflection. So, and then when these negative sides, negative aspects have been abandoned, and you have a fairly pure mind state, that is when meditation becomes possible. So you can see here how it is a stage-wise thing. So a lot of the practice that we do at the beginning of the path is actually just the practice to purify yourself, to purify the mind, to abandon the unwholesome things. And then it's like the real meditation can start to happen when you get to that point. So a lot of the things that you do initially is just the purification process. Okay, so that is the that gives you some of the background on how to overcome these things. Now I'm going to read out something. I have one of these Kindles with me. It's very handy because we have all the suttas in Pali and English and everything. It's very, very good. So you don't have to carry a big library around with you. It's quite handy. Okay, so this is. I said that there's two things that you need to do. You need to have the motivation to overcome the unwholesome states, and you need to have the means, you know, how to do it. So what I'm going to do now is read a small text. This is from another sutta, which I haven't actually included here. And this is about how to get the motivation to abandon these things. So this is a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's called the Two Kinds of Thoughts Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 19. And here the Buddha talks about his own practice before his awakening. And what he says is that as he was practicing before his awakening, he divided his thinking into two parts. The wholesome kind of thoughts about metta, compassion and renunciation. And on the other hand, the unwholesome thinking, sensual desire, cruelty and ill will. And so what he does then, once he has divided the thinking in this way, and whenever an unwholesome thought, sensual desire, ill will arises, this is how he thinks. So he thinks, this thought of sensual desire or ill will or whatever has arisen in me. This leads to my own suffering, to others' suffering, to the suffering of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and it leads away from Nibbana. When I considered in this way, then that thought subsided in me. So when a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. So this is the reflection. This is basically the thing which motivates you to overcome these things, is to understand that they actually lead to suffering. This is essentially what it's about. So how does anger, for example, take ill will, how does anger lead to suffering? That's probably the easiest one to understand. And I think it's quite easy to understand that. It's quite easy if you look at all the problems in the world, most of the violence, most of the things that happen, a lot of that, a large proportion of that comes from ill will, anger, negativity. And I'm sure we have almost every person in existence has sometimes done things that we don't really want to do as a result of anger. And it's like with many things in life, unless you actually keep it in check, unless you do something with it, it can also get out of control, right? It can increase, it can get worse. So this is the problem with anger. Anger, one of the things is, you know, sometimes people think that, oh, you know, I wouldn't do anything bad against someone else out of anger. But the point is, I think every one of us, we have that potential inside of us to do bad things because of defilements. It's easy to judge others and think that others are do bad things, but essentially, I think all of us have that possibility of doing things that actually are really bad towards others. And when you recognize that potential, when you are really honest with yourself, and it's important to be honest about these things, right? You can't really pretend these things away. When we are honest about these things, we see things as they actually are, then you also get a very powerful motive to getting rid of these things, which causes all these problems. And of course, if you then take into account the Buddhist idea of rebirth and karma as well, which was mentioned in the previous sutta, then it becomes even more powerful, right? If you get carried away in this life, maybe you get the wrong influence, the wrong conditioning on you, suddenly you're heading in the wrong direction. And suddenly when you're heading in the wrong direction, you do all kinds of stupid things that you would never thought you would have done. And then you end up in a very bad way in a future life. So the only way really, in the end, the only way to overcome these things, to make sure that we don't actually, do the wrong thing, the only way is to make sure that we develop the opposite. We develop as much kindness, compassion, metta as possible, and reduce these defilements to the maximum. So, for your own sake, and also for the sake of other people, these things, as it says here, both for, one's own affliction, for one's own sake, and for the sake of others, and for the sake of both, we need to abandon these things. And then it says here that it obstructs wisdom, and the Pali for this is Panya Nirodhika. And Panya Nirodhika literally means it makes wisdom cease. That's actually what it means. Would you like to be wise, or would you like to be stupid? And it's nice. Wisdom is a very beautiful thing, right? A wise person. What is a wise person? A wise person is somebody you can go to, you can maybe ask them a question, they can help you solve a problem, usually in a very deep way. They were able to see through things, and they will see through the superficial of things and see the deep causes of the problems. That's what a wise wisdom actually is all about. Wisdom is something very profound. And I think that, certainly for myself, one of the reasons why I like the Buddha's teaching so much is precisely because it is about this idea of wisdom, being able to solve profound, deep problems, being able to move away from suffering and towards happiness and contentment. So for me, if something destroys wisdom, it is very, it's very bad news. It's a very good reason to get rid of it. And this is one of the things the Buddha, when he talks about defilements like desire and anger, he says they are like perversions or inversions of the mind that turn the mind like upside down. You see the mind, you see the world in an inverted way. It is when you're angry, that's when you do things that you regret afterwards. You never do those things when you're peaceful, right? Anger makes you do things that you regret afterwards. Same thing with desire. If you have desire for something, very often you might do something that you regret afterwards. You get a strong desire, you get very attracted to somebody, even though you are married or you are in a relationship. And then you do something afterwards, you have an affair or something, and afterwards you feel really bad about it. But at the time, when the desire was there, it seemed right. The inversion of perception. So that is how it, how it destroys the wisdom. And one of the interesting things, somebody asked me something today, like a personal question about how to deal with a particular situation. And one of the things to always remember, if you need to deal with something, if you need to make a decision in life, whether you should do A or you should do B, one of the kind of important ground rules for making decisions is to always wait till you feel peaceful. Don't make decisions when you're angry. Don't make decisions when you are confused. Don't make decisions when you have some kind of strong desire. Because all those things are going to distort the outlook. Wait till you feel peaceful. Wait till the mind is clear. When the mind is clear and you feel peaceful, that is the right time to make decisions. So that is the making the wisdom cease. The next one here is that it says it causes difficulties. And the Pali here basically means that these defilements, they are painful. If you have the choice between having a defilement in the mind and being free of that defilement, just the difference in how it feels for you personally is actually very large. The peaceful mind is a much more beautiful state than a mind with defilements. And the last part here is that it leads away from Nibbana. So you can imagine Nibbana basically is, if you imagine the qualities of Nibbana, Nibbana is like peace, right? Nibbana is a sense of freedom from problems, freedom from suffering. Nibbana is a sense of feeling cool, feeling at ease. It's basically a very positive feeling. That's what Nibbana is. So when these defilements are there, you're moving away from all these qualities that you're really searching for. So these are the kind of reflections that give you the motivation. You remind yourself of why these things are bad and why they don't work. And if you think across many lifetimes, you think that in a future lifetime, you may not come across good friends, right? You may not come across a good influence. You may be influenced by bad things. And this is one of the problems with the Buddha's teaching, because according to Buddhism, there is no self inside. There is no kind of entity which guides you in the direction. You're always just this moving thing here. You're like this ship on the ocean, which moves according to the wind. Not according to its own steering, that's like a self, but just according to the wind. So where you're going depends on the conditions around you, depends on the circumstances. And that's quite scary in a way, right? There's nothing guiding you. So because of that, there's always a sense of urgency. Now the opportunity is there. The opportunity may get lost again. And when you think like that, then you get the sense of now is the time to act. So these kind of reflections, you know, when you do them again and again, and you think about them from different angles, you read what the Buddha said about these things, and after a while, it starts to sink in. After a while, you start to look at the world in a new way. And that is when the motivation to do something becomes stronger. Like everything in life, it takes a lot of persistence and perseverance. And only then does it really bear results. Okay, so that is the motivation for you. So that is how you get motivated. You understand the suffering, the problems with these things. And once you have the motivation clear, let's look a bit more about how to actually overcome these things. What are some of the methods, some of the ways to deal with these things? Okay, so the next sutta is the one about removing resentment. It comes after the one we just saw before. So, removing resentment. So, I'll read out. This is actually a sutra spoken by Venerable Sariputta. Venerable Sariputta was like the right-hand monk of the Buddha, and he was often considered the wisest person in the Sangha after the Buddha himself. Okay, so this is how it goes. So then, or rather there, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the monks. Friends, monks. Friend, those monks replied, and the Venerable Sariputta said this. Okay, friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. What five? Here, a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. Two, a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. Three, a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. Four, a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. Five, a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment toward such a person. Okay, so the idea here is that you have five types of people, and the idea is that these five types of people, they include everyone, right? You have from the person who has no good qualities, all the way to the person who has all good qualities, and everyone in between is also included here. So this is basically a method whereby you can remove anger, or as it says here, resentment towards anybody. That's the idea. Okay, so let's have a look at the first person here. So the first person, this is how you think in regard to the first person. And how, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is, whose bodily behavior is impure and whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-robed monk sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. So the idea here is that people are usually very complicated, right? People have different sides to them. People will have good aspects, they will have bad aspects. And this is what you find many, very quite frequently. with many different people. So because people have different sides to them, you can actually choose to focus on certain aspects. And when you focus on the right aspect, then you abandon any negativity you may have because of the negative aspects. And it's not that difficult to do, because you know, as if you want to practice in a nice way, if you want to do what is good to other people, you want to give people the benefit of the doubt, right? So because you want to give them the benefit of the doubt, it's actually not that difficult to see the good sides and then just allow the bad sides to kind of disappear. And this, in a sense, becomes the foundation for the practice of metta and loving-kindness. Because loving-kindness is just that. Loving-kindness is the ability to see the good in someone else. And when you focus on that good aspect in somebody else, that's when a sense of kindness and metta and love is possible. So it is a very, very useful thing, and I think it is something anyone can do. It just needs, again, all of these things, they need practice, right? It's not easy straight away, but by reflecting, if there is a person in your life who you find is very difficult to have, who you have problems with or whatever, but if you, as soon as you can start to see something good in that person, that is where you're able to start to change your perception. Whenever the negative aspect of that person comes up in your mind, you remind yourself straight away, wait a minute, there is something good here. Why am I focusing on the bad? Okay, so that's the first person. You can see the nice simile there of the rag-robed bhikkhu. A rag robe is like one of these robes, but it's made out of like cloth which is found, you know, thrown away. Cloth which often is found on a corpse, for example, or cloth which is just thrown away in the forest. And you take all this cloth together and you sew a robe. That's basically what a rag robe is. So you take this rag and you pull off all the bad things and you keep the good part. Okay, so that's the first person. So let's have a look at the second person here. And how, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands and drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. So, the same principle as before, right? It is a different aspect of the person. And you can see here how a man arrives afflicted and oppressed, right? If you are angry with somebody, it's like you have an affliction. It's like being ill, in a sense, when you're angry. So you are afflicted. And because of that anger, what you do, you sweep away all the negative things. And then you dive in and you cool yourself down by focusing on the good things in that person. Okay, so then we have the third person. And how, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Suppose there is a little water in the puddle, then a person might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink from it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and then depart. He then gets down on all fours, sucks it up like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of the bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the placidity of the mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. It's quite nice, isn't it? It's the ability to see, even if somebody has only a very small amount of good qualities, you focus in on that and you allow that to kind of guide your state of mind, guide how you look at that person, It's a very, very beautiful thing, a beautiful way of dealing with other people. In this case, his outward behavior of this person is not very good, but it says he gains an opening of the mind. An opening of the mind here is like the opposite of having defilements, right? The opposite of the nivarana. Nivarana in Pali is like an obstruction, the five hindrances. An opening of the mind is the opposite. So somebody who sometimes gains that clarity, gains that freedom from defilement. That's what it's meant here. Placidity of the mind means that peace of the mind that comes when the defilements are not there. You may wonder, how do you know that somebody is, if the external behavior is bad, how can you know that they sometimes have a very peaceful state of mind? And basically the way you know that is, it's like everything else in life. You know that by observing somebody. And when you observe somebody long enough, you know a lot about that person. You know a lot about how their mind works. So what that means is that sometimes we have to exert ourselves. We have to put forth effort to be able to see the good in other people. But when you put forth that effort, then it is often possible to find something that you can use as a contemplation. But you have to be very careful, right? Because just like when you drink from a tiny little puddle, you have to be careful you don't stir it up. If you look a little bit to the left, or you look a little bit to the right, you will see all these bad qualities. You have to be able to focus very narrowly on that quality. So all of this, what we have seen so far, is based on metta, the idea of kindness, the idea of seeing the good in other people. This is all based on metta. Now the next one, number four, this is based on compassion instead, on karuna. So this works in a slightly different way here. So it reads as follows. So how, friends, should resentment be removed towards a person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure and who does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, from time to time? Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. He would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man traveling along the highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man does not encounter calamity and disaster right here." So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion, one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body after death, he will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in the bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed." So this is like the case where it is very hard to see any good qualities in somebody. When somebody is very difficult, you find them very hard to deal with in all ways. Then there's always this last option. And this is to understand that this person has the problem. You don't really have a problem. Okay, you have to deal with them. But they are actually the one who have the real problem. Because they are kind of heading very powerfully in the wrong direction. And this is like one of the important tricks of perception in life. The trick usually when you get upset about something is because you're focusing on yourself, right? You think about yourself, they are behaving wrong towards me. It's all about me, me, me. And when you feel somebody's doing the wrong thing towards you, that's when you get angry. So what you're doing, you're turning the perception around. Instead of thinking about yourself, you're focusing on the other person instead. Actually, okay, I may be suffering a little bit, but they are the one who have the problem. They are the one who are creating tremendous suffering for themselves in the future. And then instead of feeling angry, you can actually give rise to compassion instead. It's not so easy to do sometimes because it's natural that we focus on ourselves. We are closest to ourselves. We feel we feel the suffering directly on ourselves, so it's quite natural. But it's very liberating when you can kind of forget about yourself a little bit and instead focus on the other person. And this is how you think about them, right? This is the simile. This is how you think about the other person. It's very beautiful simile. You think of them as somebody who is ill, right? Somebody who is sick, somebody who has a serious problem. A person who is ill, they haven't got the medicine. The medicine here would be something like a good spiritual guidance, right? Which can guide them in the right way. They haven't got an attendant. An attendant is like somebody who can help them get over the illness, like a spiritual teacher who can guide them towards a more wholesome way of thinking, right? They haven't got these things. They haven't got anything to support them. They are conditioned in a bad way. They have nothing to condition them in the right way. And because of that, that's why they're heading in the wrong direction. And then you think to yourself, oh, you can almost feel the pain in this person, right? You can see the suffering. And then the compassion arises. And this compassion then is this, oh, I hope, may this person, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, a suitable attendant. This is the nature of compassion, this wish that the other person may be relieved of the problem. And it's important to remember here again, this whole idea of, you know, rebirth is very useful to remember here as well. So if you have a feeling for the idea of rebirth in future lives, always remember that, you know, this, if your behavior is really bad, it can have very, very powerful consequences for a very, very long time in the future. And if you find that the idea of rebirth is something you have difficulty with and difficulty to relate to, then usually it's enough also to focus on the difficulties that this person encounters in this very life. So you can see now, we're basically covering all types of people, right? All kinds of people are included in this kind of setup. But it is interesting, nevertheless, that the first three ways of dealing with the people concern metta, and only the fourth way concerns compassion. And this is exactly the same thing as when you see the Brahma Viharas, you know, the four Brahma Viharas, metta, karuna, mudita, and equanimity. When you see those in the suttas, these are like the four sublime abidings or sublime states. Metta always comes first, and karuna is always second. So why is it? Why is it that metta comes first and karuna comes afterwards? And I think there is a very good reason for that. And I think the reason is that karuna, when you focus on compassion, you're also seeing the negative in somebody, right? And you're wishing them well. And when you see the negative in somebody, if you look at that too much, it's easy to get a bit sad or maybe depressed because you see the negative things in life. So to avoid that danger of falling into negativity, falling into sadness, of seeing the negative things, you actually always try the metta first. Metta should always be tried first, because metta, by its very nature, is something positive, right? You're seeing the beauty in somebody else, you're seeing something nice, so it always makes you feel good inside. So it's worthwhile taking a bit of time, trying to search for the goodness, and focus on that goodness, before you eventually move on to the compassion instead. Okay, so let's have a look at the last person. It's number five. And it goes as follows. How, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure and who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, and cool waters, with smooth banks, a delightful place shaded by various trees. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe, drink, and then after coming out, he would sit or lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, to his pure verbal behavior, and to the opening of the mind, the placidity of the mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. Friends, by means of a person who inspire confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. This is quite interesting, because here you have the person who is almost like perfect, right? Somebody who is very kind, who is very has all these good qualities, who has a good mindset, who has everything is basically right about this person. And still, people get angry at them. Still, people get upset. So it is important to be aware of that. It's important to be aware of the difference between the other person's qualities and the defilements in one's own mind. It is one of the strange things when you live with somebody for a long time, then after a while, because of you see all the different sides of that person, and because with everybody we have all have different personalities, so there's always going to be things that we clash a little bit, or we understand the world in a slightly different way. There's always the potential for some sort of conflict is always there, even if the person is absolutely pure. And you see that even in the suttas, there were people, they would go even to the Buddha who is, you know, the kind of the beacon of purity in Buddhism. Even the Buddha would get abused. Even the Buddha would be given a hard time, not because he wasn't doing the right thing, but because of other people's impurities. So when you recognize that, you know, defilements will always distort our minds, then you can actually be more humble about things. And you can say, okay, maybe the problem actually is me. Maybe I'm distorted in this case. Then you can guide your attention back on the good qualities of this person. And the last sentence here, it says that by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. So really, the idea is that when somebody really has good qualities, you should be able to gain, this is actually where confidence in Buddhism comes from. This is where you see the good qualities of the Buddha, you see the good qualities of the spiritual teacher, and that's actually where you should find confidence. So you have to be very careful in those cases, not to allow yourself to be distracted by just your own defilements, basically. So there you are. So that is the five ways of removing resentment. And as you can see, this list covers everybody. Everybody is included within this list. And a very powerful technique, I reckon, there for helping you overcome the bad states of mind. Okay, so let's go on to the one more sutta. We have about a little bit of time left, so we can move on to the next one, which I think is the I'm not very clear on the direction here, but actually that's the wrong one. Let's go on to the abuse one first of all, because it's kind of on the same topic. So this is the one which says abuse. So SN72. This is a sutta from the Sanyutta Nikaya, and this is about just what I was talking about before, about somebody being angry with the Buddha. So this is how it goes. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. The Brahmin Akosaka Bharadvaja, the abusive, heard. It is said that the Brahmin of the Bharadvaja clan has gone forth from the household life into homelessness under the ascetic Gotama. Angry and displeased, he approached the Blessed One, abused and reviled him with rude, harsh words. The word for harsh here, the word is in Pali is parusa, and parusa is the same word as we had before when we're talking about the four ways of bad speech. One of those bad ways, harsh speech, is exactly the same word we find here. And it's interesting here, isn't it? This Brahmin, he has heard that one of his relatives has become a monk under the Buddha. And just by hearing that he has become a monk under the Buddha, he makes an assumption that this is bad. So he goes to abuse him on that basis. As in India in those days, there was like a little bit of antagonism between the Brahmins on the one hand. The Brahmins were the highest caste. And then you have the Samanas, the ascetics, on the other hand. And often they didn't like each other and they had problems between each other. And that's why this Brahmin, he assumes straight away when he hears that his relative has become a monk under an ascetic, he assumes straight away that this must be something bad, right? So what this shows us, it shows us one very, I think, a very important lesson. And the lesson is to be very careful making assumptions about things. Be very careful with judging things. It's so hard to know sometimes. In this case, it turns out that this Brahmin, he actually likes the Buddha in the end. And towards the very end, he turns around and he becomes a disciple of the Buddha instead. So it just shows us how careful one has to be making assumptions in life. It's always good to have an open mind, to, you know, think, to understand that there are other ways of looking at things, there are other possibilities. and have an open mind and always give people the benefit of the doubt is always a very powerful thing. Yeah. Okay, so this is, so what happens next is as follows. When he had finished speaking, the Blessed One said to him, "What do you think, Brahmin? Do your friends and colleagues, kinsmen and relatives, as well as guests come to visit you?" "Sometimes they come to visit, Master Gautama. Do you then offer them some food or a meal or a snack?" "Sometimes I do, Master Gautama. But if they do not accept it from you, then to whom does the food belong? If they do not accept it from me, then the food still belongs to us." "So too, Brahmin, we who do not abuse anyone, who do not scold anyone, who do not rail against anyone, refuse to accept from you the abuse and scolding and tirade you let loose at us. It still belongs to you, Brahmin. It still belongs to you." So what the Buddha is saying here is that if you accept the anger of somebody else and you respond in the same way, that is a bit like you are engaging with that person, right? And you it's like accepting the food that somebody offers you. But the Buddha says, "I don't accept it from you. And because I don't accept it from you, you keep the anger." And of course, the meaning of that is that he keeps the anger and he will have to reap the consequences of that anger. There's a nice way of thinking. If somebody gets angry at you, instead of responding with anger, you can think, you know, actually, this person has a problem, not me. Why should I be angry? And then again, you can have a sense of compassion rather than getting angry in return. Or you can think, like the Buddha says elsewhere, that somebody who is angry is also somebody who is considered insane. So if somebody is insane, if they really are mad, then there's not much point in getting angry back. So these are just ways of helping you to try to overcome anger, right? To avoid reacting to somebody else. These are very useful things. They're very simple, but very useful, because it helps you to keep a sense of balance, not to react, to be cool, to be peaceful, even if somebody else is not. So then the Buddha says, "Brahmin, one who abuses his own abuser, who scolds the one who scolds him, who rails against the one who rails at him, he is said to partake of the meal, to enter upon an exchange. But we do not partake of your meal. We do not enter upon an exchange. It still belongs to you, Brahmin. It still belongs to you." And then the Brahmin responds, "The king and his retinue understand the ascetic Gautama to be an arahant, yet Master Gautama still gets angry at him." You see, this is what I was talking about before. The danger is that when you are distorted by anger yourself, when you have defilements, you see something in other people which isn't actually there, right? So that's why you have to be very careful, because if you're not careful with that, you're going to react maybe in very inappropriate and bad ways. So the Buddha then replies, "How can anger arise in one who is angerless, in the tamed one of righteous living, in one liberated by perfect knowledge, in the stable one who abides in peace? One who repays an angry man with anger thereby makes things worse for himself. Not repaying an angry man with anger, one wins a battle hard to win. He practices for the welfare of both his own and the others. When knowing that his foe is angry, he mindfully maintains his peace. When he achieves the cure of both his own and the others, the people who consider him a fool are unskilled in the Dhamma." So there you are. That is the Buddha's reply. So you can see that there are some interesting little things in there. He says things like, in the first verse, he says, the stable one who abides in peace. In other words, this Pali word actually means the one who is such. He is in such a way. He's somebody who is unaffected by external circumstances. That's why he's the stable one, the unaffected one. And it says nicely there, it says that not repaying an angry man with anger, one wins a battle hard to win. So in other words, this ability to be able to be cool, to be able to be at peace when somebody else is angry, it is considered something very noble in this world when we can do that. And it's just about reflecting in the right way, right? You reflect, you understand. It's the other person who has the problem. Why should I react in return? You can stay at peace. You can have compassion instead. Very powerful there. It says that when you do this, then you are actually practicing for the welfare of both. When you are remaining peaceful, when the other is angry, you're actually giving the other person an opportunity to calm down and become peaceful. This is exactly what's happening with this Brahmin in this story here. So you actually, that is the way, if you have compassion for yourself and you have compassion for the other, that is how you practice for the welfare of both. And then when you achieve the cure of both, if you are angry, you're considered like you're ill, right? So being freed from anger is like a cure. You're cured from illness. And then when you do that, that is when you achieve the goal. And people who don't understand that, those they are considered fools according to the practice or the understanding of the Dhamma. And then you have the ending of the sutta. It says, when this was said, the Brahmin Akosa Bharadvaja said to the Blessed One, magnificent Master Gautama, magnificent. I go for refuge to Master Gautama, to the Dhamma and to the Bhikkhu Sangha. May I receive the going forth under Master Gautama. May I receive the higher ordination. Then the Brahmin Bharadvaja of the Bharadvaja clan received the going forth under the Blessed One. He received the higher ordination, and soon, not long after his higher ordination, dwelling alone, etc., etc., the venerable Bharadvaja became one of the arahants. So that is what happens when you remain cool. You create arahants in the world. That's quite nice, isn't it? You get more arahants like that. I should warn you, though, it says here, and soon, not long after the ordination, usually in the Pali, that means maybe 10, 20, 30 years, perhaps. So, okay, very good. So let's call an end there, and we'll see you again at 6 o'clock. Yeah?